that preceded the meeting, first could picture ourselves as praising our Heavenly Father for His greatness and His goodness and His majesty which He has revealed to us, which inspires us to worship Him yet more and more. And then, in the second hymn, we pictured ourselves as being on the witness stand before the bar of divine justice and mercy, giving our own personal testimony that this we believe is true of us, that God's mercy has touched me as an individual. His gate was left ajar for me as an individual. In other words, our personal testimony before God that we have felt, and we have every evidence in our own personal lives, that such has been the love of God condescending to us. And we have felt it, we have experienced it. And this, in turn, is our testimony to God as we sing His praises, that we believe with all the firmness of conviction that His mercy has reached us. A crown has been allotted us. The gate has been left open for me as an individual. And with such full assurance of faith as we sang, this would constitute our personal testimony. Today, tomorrow, and any time we were called upon to give it, we would with firm conviction sing and repeat these words, whether it be accompanied by melody, a musical instrument, or whatnot, it would make no difference. Such would be the essence of our testimony before God. And this is the privilege that we can live up to, we are admonished to live up to, and if we are living below this, we are living below our privileges, as our pastor in one place places it. So I think we should, with all the forces of life within us, live up to this privilege, this opportunity the Lord has given us, that we can give this testimony at all times and in any place. So that's not part of my subject. That was just something that I thought of while we were singing. The subject is God's dwelling place, and it will be related, as these things are, along some line. I remember, and you probably do too, as you read this book, Tabernacle Shadows, how our pastor, in the preface to the book, shows how this teaching about the tabernacle, its sacrifices, its services, and so on, was given as a gift from God to His people at the end of the age, in the harvest period. And how this book has helped so many who previous to this time, reading their Bibles, did not comprehend fully, did not grasp completely the meaning, the purposes of all these sacrifices given back there in type and shadow. But now they could see that these things pictured forth their sacrifice, the privilege of laying down their lives in the Master's service, the privilege of presenting their bodies a living sacrifice. Oh, they learned about bodies of lambs, goats, bullocks, and all these things are fine to understand and to talk about and to read about. But all these are pictures of something far grander and greater. They involve the invitation to the church to present themselves sacrifices. And these, which those only foreshadowed, are the real sacrifices that the Lord is interested in and which will affect His plan of salvation as He intended it right through to the end of the kingdom period, the millennial age. And so this was a beautiful preface to the book, and then he goes on, begins from beginning right through the whole arrangement, takes in the setting, you remember the building, the actors there, the furniture, the animals, etc., the metals, and so on, and weaves before your mental vision a picture so beautiful that it stays with you always. But in it all, it pictured something far greater. It pictured the sacrifices of the Christ during this gospel age. And so, we see, not only was this one of the reasons that God instituted this tabernacle with Israel and its associated sacrifices and festivities and its services there, not only is relating to the sacrifices, but the joys that came about as a result of these sacrifices, then the subsequent sacrifices after the Day of Atonement, all these were intended for valuable lessons to us, so that we could express the joys of the Lord as we appreciate these and live these out in our daily walk and life. Paul tells us, through the book of Hebrews especially, why these sacrifices were permitted. Foreshadowing the better things to come. Foreshadowing better things. And that in them and through them, the ministry of those actors back there was a service to the church in this particular period. These and many others, perhaps, could be listed as reasons as to why the Lord desired to have a tent put up there in the wilderness of Sinai, so that there Israel could meet with Him, and there their religious services could be centered around this. But more than this, there's still another reason why the Lord wished to have this tent built in the midst of the camp of Israel. And this sometimes this hadn't entered into my study of the tabernacle as much as it should have. But when we read the text of Scripture in which this is found, we get a still different viewpoint of the mind of God in all of this. And this comes to our attention in Exodus 25:8. Now in this 25th chapter of Exodus, the beginning of the instructions are given as to how this arrangement should be built, what should constitute it in all of its varying details. But the 8th verse is the expression of the personal feeling of not Moses, not Aaron, not his son, nor either Israel, who would be affected, by the services that would be rendered here. But this is God's own feeling in the matter. And this is what He says. He gives the instructions for them to build this tent. He says, "And let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them." Isn't this something that is kind of an additional type thought that only enhances the beauty of the whole complete picture? God wanted a dwelling place in Israel, in the wilderness. Now, already that we could have in our mind's eye thoughts which may be associated with this, related or unrelated. But probably one of the main questions that would come to our mind would be, why did God want to dwell among Israel? Couldn't He find a better place to dwell? He wanted a sanctuary so He would dwell with them. In other words, this is an expression of the condescension of God. For them to make some type of a building which would be illustrative of where He would be pleased to dwell with Israel. Needless to say, God foreknew how Israel would tempt Him in the wilderness, how they would murmur so many times, how they would disobey His commandments, how they would go back on their covenant promises. God foreknew all of these things, did He not? Oh, absolutely. Known unto God are all His works since the beginning of the world, and nothing took God off guard for a moment. And in spite of all of this, this great God of the universe could condescend to this low estate to ask Israel to build a tent for Him so He could dwell in their midst, in that camp, in the midst of those hard-hearted and disobedient and stiff-necked people. Friends, doesn't this give you an insight into the heart and mind of God that you have been looked upon or noticed before? But before we go too far, let us remember this, that Israel was a prototype of the church in the flesh. They pictured us. And you think sometimes they murmured, read your own heart and see how many times you murmured against the will of God. And if you think that they disobeyed, count the many times you have disobeyed in carrying out your covenant of sacrifice. Or you might not have done it willfully with the full intent? Perhaps not. But involved in it was a measure of disobedience. They didn't have the Holy Spirit. Notice the difference between themselves and ourselves. And yet, friends, in some way or other, that which they underwent, we touch upon and express in some form or other. Else why did Paul say in his letter to the Corinthians, he says, as they murmured, don't you murmur. As they disobeyed, don't you disobey. As they were gluttonous, I'm using my own terms now in some way, don't you be gluttonous. Why the necessity for warning us against these things, if such were not possible? If it were not possible for us to express our disobedience, our stiff-neckedness, our murmuring, like they did, why warn us about it? Why just fill in pages of an epistle to some church back then? No, we will find that in viewing the experiences of the Lord's people back there, will not tend to make us high-minded in our appreciation of ourselves right here. But a proper study and analyzation will cause to make us very humble indeed and feel like the hymns we sang, appreciating the fact that God's mercy reached down and touched us. Again, Psalm 84 tells us this. How amiable are thy tabernacles, O Lord of hosts! What is the psalmist speaking of? The tabernacle back there? No, this is in the plural. How amiable are thy tabernacles, plural, O Lord of hosts! Psalmist speaking prophetically. He's speaking of the church in the gospel age. And he puts it in the plural because each one of us is pictured as a tent of meaning. A little individual tabernacle in whom God is pleased to dwell. And in whom he is pleased to make his dwelling with us during this gospel age sojourning through the wilderness of sin. And yet, despite our many weaknesses, despite our faults and shortcomings, which are numerous, notice how God looks upon this. Amiable. The Lord's people are amiable. They're beautiful. And God, as he desires to have a dwelling place back there in Israel, in that one tent, desires to have the dwelling place in your heart and mine with a far greater fervor than he desired a dwelling place in a literal tent in the wilderness. And so God says that you are amiable to him. Isn't that a wonderful thought? God is pleased. Oh, he knows our down sitting and our uprising. He knows our thoughts while they were yet afar off. And he knows how weak we are. He knows our frame that we are but dust. He knows all of these things. And yet the expression is, how amiable are thy tabernacles. The Lord is pleased to put his name upon thee. They are his. Using the picture of a tent of tabernacle. Of course, other use the thought of sonship and other expressions that show the closeness of the relationship between God and his people during the gospel age. But we're just using this one approach of a tent or tabernacle. And did Jesus not tell us that we love his, if we love God's commandments, just like he loved God's commandments, that God would come and make his abode with us, and he, together with God, would come and dwell in us and make their abode with us? If we show our appreciation to his commandments and his will, there you have the picture again. The Spirit of God and the Spirit of Christ, in this respect, dwelling in us. We are these little tabernacles. But the prophet says that they are amiable to God. Now, in the building of this tabernacle back there, you remember that the Lord asked all of Israel to have a part in supplying the needs of the building and the materials for the clothing and for the material to sacrifice. And so, in Exodus 35:5, we read that, "Take ye from among you an offering unto the Lord." Stop right here. I think we read, I know I read these texts too fast. I do it every day, and that's my weakness. The Lord is asking them to offer something unto Him. Think of that. Asking Israel to make an offering to Him. But what could they give to Him that He didn't give them in the first place? You get the thought, brethren? And yet the Lord is pleased to place it in this perspective. To put the responsibility on you that you're offering something unto Him. But notice what it says. Such a funny, that makes it valid as such. He said, "Whosoever is of a willing heart, whosoever is of a willing heart, let him bring it, an offering of the Lord, gold, silver, and brass." There we have it. It is one thing to get a gift from God, or to get many gifts from God. But unless it is willingly offered in service to the Lord in some way or other, along one of the many lines that we are privileged to offer, sacrifice, or service to the Lord. Unless it is a willing sacrifice. And what does this mean, willing? An appreciation of the fact that God is a giver of every good and perfect gift, and every good that we have ever known, or anything that we possess, has come to us from Him. Now this is an expression of our love to God, to in some way use this little that He has given us as an offering in His service. But it has to be a willing heart. Remember how Paul puts it in one place, if there be first a willing heart. If there is not a willing heart, friends, you can offer it. But it won't benefit you. Or it won't benefit me if I don't have a willing heart. It may benefit someone else who is the object of the service. But as far as ourselves is concerned, if it is not offered willingly, friends, there is no credit mark on your book, as it were. It's just an expression of an act by which someone else will benefit, but not ourselves. And yet the Lord asked all Israel to offer. What a sentiment here. Give everyone an opportunity to get into it. Because in that everyone becomes involved to some degree, they are personally interested in all of this. That's the kind of service the Lord wants. A cooperative service. Everyone with a willing heart have a part in it. Isn't that the way we have learned the spirit of the Lord too? The expression of giving everyone a little part in the service so that they will be personally attached to it. They'll feel the Lord's spirit working through them so that they could offer willingly along some line or another of service or sacrifice to Him. Yes, let all have a part in it. All will be more interested in it if they have the heart to offer and to serve. Now, in the description of this tabernacle arrangement, there are many instructions given as to what should constitute the structure, the implements, the furniture, and so on. But it's always interesting to note some trend in all of this. Now, what was the first item that the Lord mentioned that should be constructed in this whole arrangement? Well, you would say, perhaps I don't know right now. Maybe you have the right answer. Maybe you already know. In Exodus 25:10, as we go back to where we were before, you will notice that instruction. For the first item that should be made in that tabernacle was the ark of the testimony. And then, to tie in the latter part of the string while we're still thinking about it, when the tabernacle was set up and reared, that is, the structure was reared, what do you think was the first item of furniture was brought into the ark, to the tent? I gave it away. The ark again. why the preeminence of this ark in the arrangement of the tabernacle? There must have been a reason. We don't see that God just decided offhand that the ark would be the first thing, that he should give instructions to how to build it. And then once the tent was put up, that of all the furnaces, the ark should be the first one that comes in and finds its place in the arrangement. Well, there probably were many reasons why the ark was the first one. We believe that that ark contained within its makeup and its content, the embodiment of the whole mystery of the plan of God, was contained in that ark and its content. The mystery hidden from ages and dispensations. The Christ pictured in that ark, Jesus' head and the church's body, and their office and their nature and position, as shown in its content, was the mystery that was so completely veiled from the eyes of men to this day. And yet, it is that around which the whole plan of redemption throughout the whole gospel age centered. It is that which the whole, almost 4,000 years, some odd over more, that from the fall of Adam to the day of Jesus, foreshadows, and which the time yet remaining before us, in which the whole plan will be completed, all of this together is centered around that which that ark represents. The Christ, the mystery of God. Of course, all of these things could be elaborated on in more detail, but we have to go on to touch on some other things of the tabernacle arrangement itself. In this building, and as you recall its structure, out there seated in the wilderness somewhere, it's up to you. Was anything but a grand and eye-catching one. As you can readily recall, this tent, its outside covering, was an animal skin. Whether it was dark brown or dark gray, it doesn't matter. It was an animal skin. And you can just imagine how beautiful an animal skin looks in the distance, covered over a tabernacle or tent or anything. With all the dust that usually would fall or lie through the air at that particular place, you wouldn't have it shined with the gloss and the sheen as your fur coats that people wear today, you know, and they go out for the evening and make sure that their fur is just brilliantly glistening so that they would catch the eye of everyone that would pass by and see them, know. This is a piece of fur that was on the outside, nothing on top, and upon it fell all the dust and whatever flowed through the air. And you can readily imagine that it was not a very attractive or appealing to the eye. The Lord arranged it this way, that this mystery of his that was hidden within this structure, the whole arrangement, would not be very eye-appealing to the average onlooker. Be he in the world or be he in the nominal church, it wouldn't matter. It would be not an appealing structure. And then, being on land gives us the thought that this seal that had to be deferred in order to have this first place in this tabernacle, he had to be skinned, this animal. It meant kind of a change of its natural habitat. You know all this, it's the tabernacle, and this is human. Indicating that in this arrangement of God, that there would be this principle brought into the picture of a foreign object, an object which was not intended in this natural habitat to take its place there and to be projected into this particular place in God's arrangement. Now you say, that's a lot of words he said, but you haven't told us anything. Well, let us picture Jesus. He was the Logos, the perfect man, Christ Jesus. He had to leave his natural habitat, which was the heavenly court themselves, and have to come here, not among angels, not among even perfect men, but among a sin-cursed and sin-weakened and sin-diseased human family. And to take his place among men in an important category in the plan of God. And how many recognize his position in the plan of God as a result of him taking this step down from the heavenly court down to this wilderness condition of sin? No, they did not appreciate. They did not know. And it still remains a mystery. And because they do not know and do not appreciate, it remains a part of the mystery of God, as it has to do with this plan of salvation of the human family. And then beneath that was another skin, which you couldn't see now because the steel skin, the badger skin, was on the outside. But please, God, have other coverings over this wooden structure which was overlaid with gold. And so this was a ram skin dyed red, and no one saw that. It was covered underneath this other arrangement. But within the philosophy of the life of the Logos and his coming down to earth, the central feature of that is his ransom sacrifice, it's not. His willingness to pour out his soul even unto death, to lay down his perfect humanity, that a man came out to be ministered unto but to minister, and to give his life a ransom for many. What a beautiful part of the plan of God. Hidden? Yes. The most? Yes. Only to those who know the various workings of the plan of God are these things made available. They know that they're there. They know that this feature of the plan of God is important. And though hidden from the eyes of casual men and women, they know it's there. And it's part of the mystery of the plan of God as it was pictured in that tent of tabernacle. And they appreciate it. They love it. Because they know that it has a direct bearing on their having a part in that tabernacle arrangement. No. And then still underneath that covering was still another one. A covering of goat's hair. Beautiful. No doubt about it. No dust got on the undercovering, you know. And yet this curtain of goat's hair was so beautifully made. It was six curtains stitched together and five curtains stitched together. And then the way these six and five were joined is very interesting. They were loops made, you know, on the edges of these curtains. The women know about all these things very well, how these things are sewed. And then there were metal clasps on both sides so that it kept these six and five together as one. One big curtain. And these catches were made out of copper on this particular curtain. Now, why would this be made of copper when we realize that the next one, still underneath this one, had also a catch arrangement, just like the one just above it. But the next one had gold as a metal for the catches. This one had copper. How beautifully this can picture the sin offering that Jesus, together with the church, provides in this plan of God, this mystery hidden, as pictured in the typical tabernacle. We could say, I believe, in all fairness, that even though the distinction between Jesus and the church is far greater than the six and five ratio that we understand, even in the animal, the sacrifice of Jesus was pictured by a beautiful prime bullock. Have you ever seen a bullock of a year old in good health? And have you ever seen a scrawny goat of under a year in good health? Why, you could see in your mind the difference between the two. So this isn't so readily shown in the six and five, but we'll accept it for lack of a better reason. That it pictures the sin offering of Jesus, the larger part, and the church, the smaller part. And the basis of that offering for sin was the humanity that's offered. Jesus offered his perfect humanity as an offering for sin. and the church offers it reckoned perfect humanity. Still pictured by the copper thatcher. This constitutes the sin offering for the whole world of mankind. And when you think of a sin offering, you immediately associate with it sacrifice, don't you? Of course you do. That was the essence of the whole tabernacle arrangement. As far as its service was concerned, its essence was sacrifice, was it not? Yes. That's why a priest was ordained back there, to offer gifts and sacrifices on behalf of the people. So this thing brings to our mind this association of sacrifice immediately into the picture. And yet, sacrifice isn't a word with which most people are unfamiliar. Oh, they've heard of it. The nominal church hears about the word sacrifice continually, we believe. And what does it mean to them, really? What does it mean to sacrifice so that you can be counted in as a part of the sin offering for the whole world of mankind? This is really a mystery. Mystery, mystery, all the way down the line. From beginning to end, it's hidden. And yet it's there, because it has been revealed to only the few who are involved. The nominal church sends out its missionaries to Africa, to South America, parts of Asia, the darker parts of this world. They're willing to give up a lot of things for what they believe is the will of God. But yet, that does not mean that they have a part in the sin offering for the world of mankind, does it? If it did, then the direction for us would be get into some missionary work and get out there so you'd be part of this great sin offering for the world. They sacrifice a lot of things, don't they? And yet it doesn't mean that they are counted as part of the sin offering for the whole world and are shown in this goat's hair curtain. What does it mean to sacrifice as a part of the world's sin offering? It means, with the knowledge of God and His plan that you and I have, and the invitation which He has given us to lay down our lives in sacrifice, to be willing to suffer for sin. Willing to suffer. Take it like Jesus took it. Patiently, lovingly, to be willing to take the blows and the rebuffs of sin, whether it's in your own flesh or in the flesh of others around you, to take the rebuffs and the blows of a sin-sick world as they are directed to you, because they know that you are different. You're serving God in your own way, and they understand it not. So they will direct, like our morning study showed us. Satan will make sure that those who are deluded and are misled and misguided by him, he will direct their efforts, hit their blows upon you. And will you be willing to suffer all this from the hand of sinners? Because you are intelligently offering your humanity in sacrifice. And Jesus showed you. Are we willing to suffer in this respect? If we are, then we don't need to go to Africa or to the Amazon to teach natives about Jesus. This can come to us in our own neighborhood. It comes to some of us from our own family, where there's a division in the family as to who may or may not be in the truth. Yes, it comes that close. So you see then how the willingness of each one of us to lay down our life in sacrifice, to have a part in this mystery of God, to be part of the world's sin offering, so that if successful, if faithful, in this willingness of sacrifice, and we still get that train running through the whole thing, if there be first a willing heart, it's got to run through all of it. Intelligence and understanding, yes. But the lifeblood is the willingness in all of it. That gives it life. That gives your sacrifice value in the Lord's sight. Yes, that being part of the world's sin offering. So that on the basis of faith and the teachings of the Lord, you know that God will then use this company to remove the whole body of sin, like Paul says in Romans 6, in the millennial kingdom of Israel. Yes, those who willingly submit themselves to the blows of sinners in their service to the Lord, from no matter what direction or how it comes to them, if they do this joyfully and willingly, they'll have the privilege of removing the whole mess with which the whole human family is engulfed and has been since the fall of Adam. And friends, only a little reflection and meditation will give you a picture of how the world is involved in sin and how this mass of sin has them all in its clutches, from which they cannot break away. No matter what effort they put forth, they are slaves of sin. And that these, the little flock, together with the head, will have the privilege of breaking this and freeing mankind forever from this enemy of sin. Isn't it a wonderful thing, friends? The thing that God has offered this to people like you and me. And then there was one more curtain. The time is fleeing and I'm on one curtain too long. Now this is a beautiful curtain. That was the first one that went over the wooden structure. This had the beautiful cherubim and seraphim interwoven in with these beautiful cords, you know. And it was the only one that the priest saw when he went into the building. It was the first one that they put on the wooden structure. This was joined five curtains and five curtains. Now, there wasn't no six and five, but five and five. With these beautiful little loops there of blue, and then the golden clasp to keep it together. Well, what is this picture? Oh, this is a beautiful picture. The promise of God in joint heirship with Jesus. Remember how the prophet Isaiah puts it? You can just find it in a moment. I think it's in the 53rd chapter of Isaiah. I like to quote it word for word. Memories are too bad to go on. Therefore will I divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong. There is your joint heirship. God will give this portion, the inheritance, to Jesus, and he will divide it with the strong, the church, the strong one, the death of Jesus. Yes, join heirship with Jesus. And all of these beautiful heavenly promises concerning the outcome of the plan of salvation of God. But you know, it was a wonderful thing. Do you know, do you remember where these two curtains that they were joined together, just where were they placed over that wooden structure? Do you know where they were placed? Exactly over those pillars that divided the holy and the most holy, and from which the second veil hung. These golden patches were laid right across on top of the second veil. Why do you think it was divided so beautifully? To cover the tabernacle evenly? Perhaps. But it wasn't necessary to cover the tabernacle evenly on the first curtain. There were three more on top of it. But friends, don't you see the picture? Your joint heirship together with Jesus depends on what? Your willingness to go all the way with Jesus in the sacrifice until you go beyond the second veil, which pictures the death of the human body. Just like the first veil pictures the death of the human body. Yes, it was placed there so beautifully, right across the top of the second veil. That's where joint heirship hangs, friends, and that's where it depends upon your willingness and mine to go with Jesus all the way into a sacrificial place. And then, Joshua is coming up now. He's got a minute or two to go. I was thinking of two more things. There was a fire that covered that tabernacle by night and a cloud by day. Why do you think God chose a cloud and fire? Well, you say, he could see a cloud in the daytime and he could see fire at night. Well, that's fine. Then Israel would know. When God gave the direction to move, this cloud would go up and begin moving in the daytime. So that meant Israel start packing, start dissembling, and this cloud gives you direction. And at night, the same thing. If this appearance of fire over the tabernacle began to raise itself up and start moving, that indicates Israel, start packing and start disassembling and get moving. But what else would this picture to us? The priesthood who are interested in the antithetical significance. What are some of the best evidences that the Lord is dealing with you and with me, as could be pictured in the cloud and in the fire? Why, you know it. It's easier. One in one minute. What does the cloud picture? Trouble. What does the fire picture? Trial. What are the best evidences that you are a son of God? If you receive chastening from the Lord. If you have no trial pain and no chastening, Paul says that we could pretty well question our standing in God's sight. So therefore, that which the more readily pictures our relationship with the Lord, how strange that in our off-guard moments when a trial comes to us, one of the first things that comes to our mind is, I wonder if God forgot about me. Why would he permit such a terrible trial to come upon me? What have I done to deserve this? Don't you see, friends, the flesh rushes in to supply the answer. And it takes the spirit a little while longer to begin to analyze and realize later that these trials are permitted because they're evidences of the love of God. The evidences that he is directing our path through this wilderness of sin. And how thankful we should be for these blessings in disguise, although Peter says no trial for the present seems joyous to be here. Yet afterward, he says, it brings the peaceable fruit of righteousness to the little flock who are exercised properly. And then one more thought. I said to John, when he comes up, I should be finishing in a moment. So Psalm 132:13-14, and we will see what we've been leading up to during this whole hour. Here again is God's testimony. Not in relation to what he said to Israel back there in Exodus 25. No, this is something sweeter. One of the sweetest texts of scripture in the whole Bible. Oh, there are many of them. But this is one of the sweetest and the most touching. This is what the Lord said. Psalm 132:13-14. For the Lord hath chosen Zion. He hath desired it for his habitation. God desired this for his habitation. Do you know what that means when God desires something? Now this is God's answer. This is God speaking. This is my rest forever. Here will I dwell. Again, for I have desired.